turns out, vitamins and supplements may not be all they're cracked up to be.
There are many cases that have been verified in the past, and you could find right now, of dietary supplements of all kinds containing not what they say they contain, and then often containing contaminants that actually be dangerous, like heavy metals, or even substances that are active in your body and could cause bad side effects that are not revealed on the label.
That's Catherine Price. We talk with her about her book, Vitamania. Then, we've all been on them, but they never seem to work in the long run.
Diets don't work for a lot of reasons, biological, psychological. We can partly blame evolution for diets not working.
That's food psychologist Tracy Mann. She tells us why diets don't work and how we can get to and stay at our leanest livable weight. Her book is Secrets from the Eating Lab, The Science of Weight Loss. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The vitamin, mineral, and supplement industry, or VMS, is one of the fastest growing sectors of the world economy. More than half of Americans report taking vitamins and supplements on a regular basis. But VMS products are not required to be tested for safety or efficacy before being sold. And that's bad because recent scientific reports have shown that many are contaminated, including with toxic heavy metals, or contain none of the ingredients listed on the labels. The problem is so bad that New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and 13 other states' attorneys general have asked Congress to investigate the industry and push for a more robust oversight role for the FDA. My guest, science journalist Catherine Price, has written a fascinating account of the largely unregulated VMS industry in her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. She also writes about what vitamins are, what they do for us, and how best to get them into our bodies. Her book is a comprehensive look at an issue of vital importance. Catherine Price is a science and health writer. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Popular Science, Slate, and the Best American Science Writing. Well, Catherine Price, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
I was thrilled to see your book because I have to tell you, I was raised by a mother who was a vitamin fanatic, and I became less and less convinced how safe and effective they were, and reading your book really told me why. It was published right in the midst of news reports showing that some 80% of vitamins and supplements tested at some major vitamin store chains like GNC had none of the listed ingredients, but did have contaminants like grass or weeds. Were you surprised at these findings?
I wasn't surprised at those findings. There were a couple caveats to that investigation, that it was just herbals, and also they may have used a testing method that was not the correct one to actually identify what was in those bottles. But with that said, I am not at all surprised that there is a problem with dietary supplements and herbals not containing what they say. And there are many cases that have been verified in the past, and you could find right now of exactly what the Attorney General found of dietary supplements of all kinds containing not what they say they contain, and then often containing contaminants that actually be dangerous, like heavy metals, or even substances that are active in your body and could cause bad side effects that are not revealed on the label. So unfortunately, no, it's not really a surprise.
So you're saying even though the testing may not have been completely up to snuff, that you think that if there were testing done that was more rigorous, it would find have basically the same findings?
Yes. I just bring up that testing issue because the supplement industry is using it as a primary defense that says, oh, they shouldn't have used DNA barcoding. They should have used a different method. Therefore, this is totally invalid and everyone should ignore it and supplements are fine. But that's not true. Supplements are not fine in many cases. And there have been tests done in the past and tests that are ongoing by third-party companies and even the government finding that there are serious issues when it comes to supplements and what they contain.
So before we go any further, can you tell us what is the difference between vitamins and supplements?
That's a great place to start because we often confuse them when we talk about the two things. I did this myself before I really got into writing about it. So there's actually only 13 vitamins, and they are the letter vitamins. It's A, C, D, E, K, and then there are 8 B vitamins. And those B vitamins are known by names like riboflavin, thiamin, niacin. So those are dietary chemicals that we need in very small amounts that we usually get from our food that prevent a specific deficiency. And if we didn't have those vitamins, we wouldn't be able to perform all of the necessary chemical reactions in our body, and we would develop horrible diseases and in many cases die. So they're essential. The word dietary supplement, on the other hand, is a much bigger catch-all term that refers to not just vitamins and mineral supplements, but also amino acids, herbals, botanicals, glandulars. I forgot what some of the other words are for it, but basically everything you see when you go into a GNC counts as a dietary supplement. And whereas there are 13 human vitamins, the latest estimates I have for the number of dietary supplements in America are it's 85,000. So it's a much bigger category.
Wow, that's a huge amount. And this is an industry that is largely unregulated. I think something that would really surprise most Americans is that the FDA doesn't regulate vitamins for safety and efficacy. You write extensively about this, and it's a really fascinating part of your book, a large part of the book, just the political wars over this. I wonder if you could start with some of the early pushes to regulate. For example, there was a case with a Massengill company. I think people now associate it with vaginal care products. But at the time, they produced something that had pretty devastating consequences.
Yes. So the history of America's food and drug and then later supplement laws was very interesting and very complicated. So the first thing I would say is that vitamins and dietary supplements are regulated by the FDA. It's just that they're not regulated in the way that you or I would think they are, or perhaps would like them to be. So they are not required to be tested for safety or for efficacy before being sold. So that's the big thing that should give consumers pause. So if you look back historically about, you know, to see how this came to be, that used to be true for America's drugs as well. You didn't have to prove that they were safe or effective. And in the era of patent medicines, like the turn of the 20th century, that resulted in medications that had all sorts of things in them that perhaps were not a good idea, like morphine or opium, which would not really qualify as safe in today's marketplace. But the example you're speaking about was a product, Elixir. It was basically one of the first antibiotic drugs that was created, and it was considered a wonder drug. And the company was making this product, but the problem was it could only be available in a pill, and it was a difficult pill to swallow, as the saying goes. So they're trying to figure out some way to make a liquid form of this drug, and they were the first ones to succeed. So they created this, I think it was a raspberry flavor, but some kind of flavored syrup that was that contained this drug, and it got shipped all around the United States. But what was not acknowledged or known. Some arguments I've seen says that the company did have some evidence of this, but regardless, no one stopped it from being shipped. It contained a contaminant similar to some stuff in antifreeze that's deadly. And so there was this horrible wave of deaths, mostly children, caused by this drug. And there was really no way for the government to go after Massengill, which seems crazy, except for the fact that they called it an elixir. And if you use the word elixir, it was supposed to contain alcohol in it, and this drug didn't contain alcohol in it. So the fact that it killed hundreds of children was not actually the technical way that the FDA was able to step in and do something. It was because it was considered mislabeled. So yeah, that kind of spurred the need for stronger drug laws in the U.S., and that's how we kind of got in the path that we are today, where prescription drugs require a huge amount of money and time and research before they can go on the market.
Prescription drugs, but not vitamins. Let's just use the word as you do sometimes, vitamins and supplements, just to stand for the whole thing. Why not?
Yeah, so the supplements, including vitamins, are treated more like foods. And it's interesting because I think that that actually gets back to what we were talking about in terms of how those words are used interchangeably. Because if you think about the vitamin, as I was just defining an actual vitamin, there are substances found in foods that we need to get usually from our diets, right? So they are foods. So if you're going to talk about vitamin C that's in an orange, it doesn't really make sense to regulate an orange as a drug because it's just a chemical in an orange that we happen to need. Now, if you take the C out of the orange and you put it into a tablet and you concentrate it and you make it a dose that's more than you'd be able to get in 200 oranges, then you have a question of whether that vitamin is still a food or if it's now a drug. Then if you take the word vitamin and you use it to apply not just to vitamin C or stuff that's found in food, but to herbals and botanicals or bodybuilding powders or all the other stuff currently used for that, then you really have trouble, in my mind, treating it as a food because it's not, you're taking those products for a medicinal purpose. But regardless of that logic, they are treated as food, or mostly as food. It's more like foods than drugs. And that is in large part because of this connection and this lump association with vitamins, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So there was real pushback to the regulation of them. Maybe we don't have to go all the way back, but to the Proxmire Bill of 1974. Could you talk a little bit about that? Now, this was William Proxmire, who, you know, was one of my legislative heroes because of, you know, he was a progressive, a liberal, he was anti-war. I thought he was a great guy, but after I read your book, Vitamania, I wasn't so sure.
Yeah, you know, well, it's interesting because the story of vitamins really does go down both sides of the aisle. Yes, this was an amendment enacted in 1976, also known as the Vitamin Mineral Amendment. And it, basically, the FDA had started to get concerned in the 60s about people taking superdoses of vitamins. And it sounds like your mom may have been one of those people who was causing them concern. Yep. Because, you know, there's a big move towards natural health, and natural being put in quotes there, and distrust of the government. So, yes, in the 60s, there was an increasing distrust in the government combined with this interest in natural healing and people like Adele Davis really pushing the idea that superdoses of vitamins would be good. And the FDA became concerned about what might happen if you start having people taking doses of vitamins that were way beyond what you could find in food. So they started to try to come up with some regulations that would define what a vitamin supplement would have to contain. So similar to if you have an extra strength Tylenol, like what that actually means, and set some standards for if you're selling a multivitamin, it has to have this combination of vitamins in it, stuff like that. But the supplement industry, which at that point was focused primarily on vitamins and minerals, there wasn't as much other stuff on the market then, but they did not want to have these limits put in place. And so with the help of William Proxmire, they got this amendment passed that basically permanently forbade the FDA from ever setting a limit on the level of a vitamin or mineral that could be in a product. They have to prove after the fact that it's unsafe. The FDA can't prevent companies from putting useless ingredients into their products. And they can't set standards to define like what a multivitamin is. So it limited the FDA's ability to kind of set definitions. And that's why if you go to a store today and you look at a gummy vitamin that's advertised as a multivitamin, it will have different vitamins and different concentrations than a chewable vitamin. And even the chewables will have different combinations of vitamins in them because there's no standard.
I find it extraordinary the idea that the FDA was forbidden from regulating what could be potentially really dangerous. I mean, you're talking about the difference between something called the precautionary principle, where you have to prove a product is safe before it's sold, and a kind of, you know, mass experimentation on the American consumer.
Yes, you could take that argument. And it is interesting because, you know, these laws differ by country. But in places like the European Union, where they're trying to set laws on this, and I believe also in Canada, there are rules in place that are similar to what the FDA was trying to do, where if you exceed a certain percentage of the recommended dietary allowance, the vitamin is treated more like an over-the-counter drug than as a food supplement. Or there has to be some kind of proof that it's safe or, you know, effective before you sell the vitamin. And that doesn't need to require new research and years of trials to make sure that vitamin C prevents scurvy, but you need to submit something ahead of time that says, okay, there's a scientific agreement that this is what it does. And we can also cite these other studies that other people have done that show that it's not going to kill you. And then that can be substantiation before the vitamin or whatever the supplement is goes on the market. So that does exist in other countries, but not here.
Well, Catherine Price, you also talk in Vitamania about the, I think it's pronounced the DSHEA.
The Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994.
So I remember that fight. I am now ashamed to admit that I'm one of those consumers who wrote in a public comment, because I had been convinced by a New York Times article that you write about in your book that that the U.S. government was trying to keep me from being able to access herbs. And I use herbs to make my own medicines, and I didn't want to have to get a prescription for, you know, thyme or marjoram.
So it's we have you to blame. I thought it was the industry, but it's Francesca.
Well, I actually got the petition information from my local Whole Foods.
Well, yes. I mean, it was a very interesting and very effective effort by the industry to take things a step further than they had come from that last law I was talking about and try to create legislation that would permanently, you know, protect the supplement industry from having to prove this safety or effectiveness. And they did it again in a brilliant way. First of all, by focusing on vitamins, the 13 vitamins in food, saying that the government wants to take your vitamins away. And there's a very funny TV clip that one association ran around that time, and it features Mel Gibson, and he is in his bathroom in a bathrobe, or maybe it's his kitchen, and he's trying to take vitamin C, and then scary music comes on, and these people, there's like a SWAT team in the back of a van, dressed in black with rifles and whatever, and they bust through his door and into his kitchen and find him with this bottle of pills, and he's got his hands up, and he's like, "Come on, guys, it's just vitamin C. You know, like in oranges." And then it has a scrolling bar that says, "Don't let the government take your vitamins away. We can stop this, you know, right to the FDA, whatever." So that was very effective. You are not the only one who listened to that. They got, I think it was millions of letters in response to this. So the supplement industry basically framed it as an issue of vitamins, and they also framed it as an issue of personal freedom, that the government was going to try to take away people's freedom to take care of their own health. And it really worked. And so what ended up happening is this basically industry-written bill got passed with a lot of public support, and it's still in effect today. But it's interesting to think, you know, is this ultimately what consumers wanted and how we would define freedom, or is it what the industry wanted?
Yeah. And you also write about your attempts to find out more about the herbs that were in a product that you were looking for. You had a skin problem. You went into a GNC, I believe, and they sold you a sea buckthorn omega 7.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds very healthy to me.
The box looks healthy too.
But then you went looking to find out what exactly do these ingredients do, and I guess that bill didn't make it any easier to find out. What happened?
Yeah, so I was having, and I still have problems with just dry skin, and I was trying to think or figure out some kind of solution, because I'd tried all sorts of like steroid creams and got a dermatologist, and I thought, well, maybe I'm writing this book, maybe I should try to find a solution in a supplement. I should first of all say I did find a solution since then, and it's called slathering my hands in petroleum jelly before I go to bed and wearing socks as I sleep on my hands. I look like a mime, and it's probably shouldn't admit it to the world, but if you got really dry hands, very helpful. But anyway, at that point I went in and I was recommended this product, and I decided to use that as an example of what it would take to actually research whether a supplement is going to do anything for you. So the first challenge that I actually did not really get into is whether that sea buckthorn box actually contained sea buckthorn in the quantities that it claimed. And I actually don't know to this day. I can't tell you if it did or not. But the second thing is I was trying to figure out what studies have been done to actually evaluate sea buckthorn's effects on the skin, because the box made it sound very nice. And it was like ancient wisdom, and my skin was going to be soothed and blah, blah, blah. But when I called the company and I asked, you know, what is this actually based on? Because they did reference a quote unquote clinical study or clinical trial in the back of the box, which is a frequent tactic in the marketing, is to refer to something that sounds scientific. So I asked him what that was, and he didn't know. He was very nice, but he didn't know. So he suggested that I go to PubMed, which is the government, you know, repository of all these scientific papers, and search for C. buckthorn. And he tried to do that on his computer and came up with a bunch of results, but didn't know which one they were talking about. And then he suggested I go to my local librarian and ask them for help. You know, basically, we didn't get anywhere with that. Again, he was very friendly and very nice, but I didn't learn anything about what their claims were based on. And it took a long time before I eventually found what seemed like it was the study. It was a small study that they were basing it on. But the problem was that the ingredient that they were testing as the active one, I couldn't tell if that was actually what was in the sea buckthorn I'd bought. And then the results of the study, I believe, found that that was basically the same as the placebo. So it didn't get me very far. And yeah, the petroleum jelly on hand sock solution is a lot easier and more safe and effective. I've tested for both.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Price about her book, Vitamania. It's about how our passion for vitamins and supplements may have led to more hype than health. So they can make these claims on their boxes. There's something you call the structure function claims are allowed. Maybe explain what that is. I mean, they have some limitations, but those limitations really don't seem to matter very much.
Yes. So it's appropriate to talk about this on a show called The Writer's Voice, because the distinctions on these labels and the rules for them are very much games of words. So the supplement industry originally wanted to have the right to actually claim that their products could treat, prevent, cure, mitigate a disease or a health condition. Problem is, that's the definition of a drug. So the FDA was not so into that idea, and they do not have the right to do that. So right now, if you do see a box of a supplement that claims to prevent, you know, to do any of those things, it technically is mislabeled and could be a lawsuit could be brought against it. But what they managed to get into this bill that we were just talking about, Deshae, is the right to use what are called structure function claims. And these are the claims that are just phrased slightly differently. So it'll say something like promotes urinary health instead of prevents incontinence. You know, so what if it's the same thing? And then it will have an asterisk, and then it will say these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration or whatever. I mean, it's on the box of like every supplement. You'll see this little statement on the bottom. And so that was a way to skirt the rules and be able to basically do what they wanted, but the FDA still felt like there was some restriction. And the end result is that right now, pretty much every supplement you're going to see in a store is going to have that, because you need to have some reason to give people as to why they should buy it and take it. And if you've polled the average consumer and you ask them, are you taking this to support urinary health, or are you taking it so you don't like pee your pants or whatever, they're going to say the latter. And they mean the same thing. And our intention is to take it for a medicinal purpose. But because it's phrased that way, it's okay in the eyes of regulators.
Now, I can remember going into Whole Foods and, you know, they have helpful nutritional, a person in the nutrition department or in the supplement department, you know, they had who would pull out some books or look things up in a database and would tell you what an herb could do and what it couldn't do and what the contraindications were. But you point out in Vitamania, Catherine Price, that it's actually extremely difficult to do testing on supplements and herbs. What is the state of our knowledge about these things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question for many reasons. I mean, first of all, the clerk is not really supposed to be doing that, because if you think about it, they're kind of dispensing medical advice. They're not supposed to be, you know, you don't come in and say, I'm on chemotherapy and I'm looking for something to make myself feel better, and then they give you an herb. Like, that's an interaction you would think you'd have with a doctor. So that's very strange that that happens. But yes, the interactions with herbs and the ability to tell, or with any of these things, and the ability to know what they're going to be is a big problem. So I would say, first of all, there are many herbs that are, I'm just focusing on herbs because that's the one I know the most about here, but any of these substances, there are known interactions. And the best known is probably St. John's wort, which a lot of people take for depression. It happens to interact with something upwards of 50% of prescription drugs on the market because of the effects it has on a particular enzyme in the liver. And some of those effects can be very serious. For example, if you had an organ transplant and you're taking anti-rejection drugs, St. John's wort can actually interfere with that medication. So there have been issues where people have lost transplanted kidneys and organs because of this. It can interfere with depression medication, kind of funny considering its purpose. this. And birth control is another kind of dramatic one where it can lessen its effectiveness so you can end up pregnant. So that's like a known thing. So that's not on the label. They're not going to list all those interactions on the label. They'll just say, check with your doctor. If you did check with your doctor, those would show up because they're so well known, but not many people took take those steps. But to get to your question and this bigger issue is that we just can't know what all the possible interactions are between all these substances. First, because people can be taking multiple things at one time that all could interact differently. Second, because we just haven't studied all the potential interactions between every supplement and every drug. You know, and third, you don't even know if what the supplement claims to have is actually what it has in the bottle. So you can't tell what the side effects or the interactions would be because you're dealing with a black box. And there have been instances, I mean, this is not commonplace with like a multivitamin and mineral product, but there have been instances with things like bodybuilding or sexual enhancement products or weight loss products where they're contaminated and adulterated with actual illegal drugs. So if you're really putting on weight after you're taking your weightlifting thing, it might be because it has an analog of an anabolic steroid in it. Likewise, you know, if that herb is really helping you in the bedroom, it might actually have Viagra.
Wow. Now, I mentioned my mother before, and she was literally taking 70, 80, maybe 100 pills a day. Now, I have to say, she died at the ripe old age of 91. But I argued with her for years, in her later years, saying, eat good food, don't take vitamins. Talk about food versus vitamins, and as a way to enhance our health and get what we need.
Yeah, so if we're talking about vitamins as vitamins, you know, these 13 substances, you can meet your needs for them. First of all, you do need them. So again, this is a situation where they are essential to life. You can meet those needs with pills, no problem, because we have, this requires us getting back to talking about vitamins as vitamins. That's just the 13 vitamins that we actually do need for health, or else we would die. So there's definitely no reason your mom needed to be taking hundreds of pills every morning. But it is interesting because if she were just worried about vitamins, she technically could have taken a multivitamin and then, you know, gnawed on cardboard and her vitamin needs would have been met. She would certainly not have lived to 91 or 2, but she would have been fine in terms of scurvy. She also could eat a whole lot of processed and refined foods like crackers or cereal or whatever else you can find in the middle of the supermarket, been totally fine in terms of vitamins. But the problem there is that the foods that have these artificial vitamins in them don't contain everything else that naturally nutrient-dense foods contain. So there's a whole lot more in a carrot than beta-carotene. There's a whole lot more in an orange than vitamin C, you know, et cetera. There's just a lot of complexity in natural foods that we don't really understand yet. And they have literally thousands of compounds in them. And we know that some of those are important for health, but a lot of them we just have no idea, but they're certainly suggestive that there's some benefit to it. So if you just take pills or if you just eat foods that have artificial vitamins, you'll be fine with vitamins, but you won't have all the other benefits that come from eating foods that naturally contain vitamins. I like to think of it in terms of people, where the way that you act when you're alone in your room is probably different from how you act when you're at work surrounded by those people, and it's probably different from how you act when you're at a party with your friends. And that's the same thing with these chemicals in our bodies or isolated into a pill or found naturally in a grapefruit or whatever.
The book is Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Our guest has been Catherine Price. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Catherine Price is a science and health writer whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, Popular Science, Slate, and the Best American Science Writing. You can read an excerpt from Vitamania by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, why diets don't work and how we can achieve and keep a healthy weight. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Briannan. Is your diet making you fat? The depressing research shows that weight loss from dieting is almost always temporary. Not only do dieters gain the weight back, but they usually pack on more pounds than before. That's because our bodies and brains are hardwired to protect us from starvation, not obesity. But as my guest social psychologist Tracy Mann shows in her book Secrets from the Eating Lab, we can learn habits that will keep us at a healthy weight, even if that's just a bit plumper than we would wish. Mann is professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota and the founder of the Health and Eating Lab at the school. Her research has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, NASA, and the USDA. Well, Tracy Mann, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Secrets from the Eating Lab, really brings together a lot of different research. There's a lot of stuff that I think would surprise many people. Really, the central thesis of the book is that dieting doesn't work.
Diets don't work for a lot of reasons, biological, psychological. We can partly blame evolution for diets not working. If you think about it, our bodies have evolved. We've evolved through famines, and we've evolved to survive a famine. So if we don't put enough food into our bodies, such as when we're dieting, a whole bunch of biological changes happen that are meant to protect us from starving to death. You know, our body just has no way of knowing that we actually are trying to lose weight, you know, that we want to have a flat stomach or something. Our body doesn't know that. It thinks we're in a famine. So when not enough food comes in, it sort of kicks into starvation mode. And all these changes happen that unfortunately make it harder to keep taking weight off and much easier to put back on what you've just taken off. These changes are neurological. So you have these changes that make you notice food more, make you think about food more, you almost become obsessed with thoughts of food. You also see hormonal changes. So the hormones that make you feel full, of course, go down. And the hormones that make you feel hungry, of course, go up. And so unfortunately, that means with the same amount of food, you're going to feel hungrier. And then there's metabolic changes. Your body basically becomes more efficient so it can get by on fewer calories. What that means is there's more calories left over to store as fat. And that's actually particularly cruel, the metabolic ones.
And yet you say that not to worry, you know, it's not all gloom and doom, that we have a certain set point. Explain what a set point is and why it keeps us within a certain range.
Well, your set weight, and I do call it a range rather than a point, but this is basically a genetically determined range of weight that your body defends. It tries to keep you in this range, and if you go out of this range, either by weighing more or weighing less, your body makes all these changes happen to bump you back into it. So people generally try to get out of their set weight range on the low end, right? They try to live at a lower weight. And what that means is you are always turning on this biological starvation mode, right? When you're below your set weight range, that's when your body thinks you're in this famine and turns on all those changes that make things difficult. So if you're going to stay below your set weight range, and people can do it, but if you're going to do it, you are going to have to battle biology every day. There's never going to be a day that you're not going to be thinking about this, about every bite that comes in, and about every bit of exercise that you're going to do.
And how broad is this set range?
No one's really been able to, like, sort of scientifically pin down, here is your exact set range. So what I find most useful is to think of your set weight range basically as where your weight tends to go when you're not doing anything extreme. So if you're not dieting and you're not in some crazy overeating phase and you're doing some reasonable amount of exercise, wherever your body kind of hangs out, that's probably right around the middle of your set range.
Now, you say that it's extremely hard to gain weight and especially keep weight above that set range as well as below it.
That's right.
But I've also heard that once you become fat, your set range will actually move upward. Is that just wrong?
Well, it's quite hard to make people obese if their set weight range is not an obese weight. So in that sense, it's very hard to live above your set weight range. But on the other hand, you can drift, you know, slowly over many, many years, you can drift upward and upward, in which case it might be harder to come back to some lower set weight range.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because I remember when I was a young woman, I could eat a bunch of ice cream for, you know, a couple of weeks going, and I'd pack on some pounds, but as soon as I stopped eating the ice cream, they just came off effortlessly. But once I hit 40, I began to pack on, you know, a pound or two each year. And yeah. Now I'm trying to get back to, you know, I mean, I'm not obese, but I'm at the upper limit of normal weight, which actually your book says might be a very healthy place to be.
Yeah, that's a great place to be. So what I recommend for people just like you is, instead of trying to live below that set range, try to just live at the bottom of it, you know, at the low end. I call that the leanest livable weight, sort of the lowest weight you can be without kicking in all that starvation mode stuff. And separately from that, just based on what you were saying about ever since you turned 40, I mean, metabolism does seem to change slowly over our lives as well. You know, think about teenagers. You know, everything just, as you described, flies right off them. I cannot believe the amount of food my 13-year-old puts in his mouth and is still a string bean. You know, he's not going to have that metabolism forever.
Now, I have another question, which is, if set range is biologically determined, and I think you make a pretty convincing case based on twin studies, you know, Twins who were raised in different households, basically having a very similar weight range. But why has there been such an increase in obesity? What's happened? Yeah. How does that fit into the scheme?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not that everybody weighs a lot more. It's not that everyone has gone from thin to obese. It's that lots of people weigh a little more. So set weight range can accommodate that kind of thing. The reason why there's more obese people over time, everybody has a pet favorite reason, you know? There's so many different factors, and I think they're all going on and they're all pushing toward people becoming heavier. So one of them is the increase in portion sizes, that you just see this in every possible context. You know, the size of soft drinks is so much bigger than they used to be. Recipe books that had additions 30, 40 years ago have the same recipes in them now with the exact same ingredients, but whereas they used to say it was made 12 servings, now that same recipe will say it only makes 6 servings. I mean, everywhere you look, portions are much larger. So that, you know, can lead people to be a little heavier. The other, I think, big difference is the amount of physical activity. And I don't mean recreational exercise. Recreational exercise has not changed over this time period. But the amount of physical activity you get as you go about your daily life has gone down by a lot. You know, things that we used to have to, you know, get off our butts and go to are now available at the tips of our fingers. I don't, to write this book, I didn't have to get off my butt. If I needed to see a journal article, a couple clicks and it's mine. I used to have to walk to a library across campus, pull heavy books off shelves, like nothing. None of that happens anymore.
So that's kind of the environment part of the influence. And one of the points you make is that this change in our environment also makes it difficult to diet successfully, that the environment is such that food is always there.
Yeah, it is always there. I mean, you have to bring snacks to your kids' soccer practice. It's an hour. They need a snack. You know, it's like strange. I don't recall that from when I was a kid.
Right. I don't recall finding candy bars in hardware stores either.
Right. Yes, good example.
We're talking with Tracy Mann about her book, Secrets from the Eating Lab. So environment, biology, what are some of the psychological impacts that make it so hard to stick to a diet or to keep the weight off after you go
Absolutely.
Off it?
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, there's a lot of psychological reasons why diets don't work that stem from the biological reasons. So think about that cruel metabolism again. You ate, let's say, 800 calories a day to get down to a certain weight. Now you're at that weight, and suddenly eating 800 calories a day isn't keeping you there. You're gaining it back doing the same thing. That is psychologically disastrous. It's going to make it really hard to motivate yourself to continue doing it. So that's one psychological thing. Another psychological thing also stemming from the biological is that when you're hungry, you become obsessed with food. You become obsessively focused on food. We actually did studies where we forbade people from eating a particular food, and we had them pick a food. And we didn't tell them to pick a food they loved or a food they hated, but a food that they were, you know, kind of neutral about. And just for a week of not being able to eat that one food, they thought about it more and wanted it more than they ever did before it was forbidden. So on most diets, you're forbidding yourself from eating various things, and all that does is make you want those things more. It completely backfires. If I could mention a psychological reason that is not why diets fail exactly, I would like to bring up willpower.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like willpower is the first thing people blame when dieters regain the weight they lost. But willpower is really not the problem or the solution. Obese people don't really have weaker willpower than thin people. People differ from each other in the amount of willpower they have, just like people differ from each other in everything, in every feature you could ever look at. But these willpower differences between people don't correlate with weight. They don't account for much variation between people in what they weigh. And I think the reason for this is that momentary lapses of willpower when it comes to eating can just flat out erase or undo previous successes. So, for example, suppose you're sitting in a meeting and somebody comes in and brings a box of donuts, you know, plops it down on the conference room table. You have to resist that donut, and that resistance is not just a one-moment thing. You have to resist it repeatedly. This takes many acts of resistance to not eat a donut. In the hour that you're in that meeting, you have to resist the donut this minute, and then the next time you look up and notice it. And then the next time. So if you successfully resist that donut 28 times during that meeting, but then you have a moment of weakness, and so on your 29th time of looking over at the box and thinking you want one, you grab one and you eat it, you've shown amazing willpower, right? You've resisted the donut 28 out of 29 times. That's A-plus territory. But you don't get credit for having shown such impressive self-control all those times. You have nothing to show for it. So eating is uniquely, I think, unforgiving of lapses in self-control. So this is why, contrary to what people expect, willpower does not relate to people's weight, because differences between people are kind of washed away by how perfect you have to be to show any evidence of having any willpower at all.
And it's one reason that you talk about in the latter part of the book, where you talk about how we can keep to the lower end of our set range, but still within it, is to keep things out of sight and out of mind,
yeah.
even just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key to living at the low end of your set range there is to not rely on willpower. Instead, what you need is to make sure you never need willpower. And the way to do that is, you know, first there's the obvious way that won't come as a surprise to anyone, is just to make sure there's not tempting food around. And that means more than just not having tempting food in the house. That means, like, change the way you drive to work so you don't drive right by the best bakery in town. You know, I did that today, and what do you know? I stopped at the bakery and I had a pastry for breakfast. You know, so there's lots of areas in which you can think about making sure you don't encounter temptation. Another one is, or at least this works for me, I change my schedule at work so that I never leave myself a really long lunch break. I never leave a lunch break long enough to actually leave campus and go into town and eat in a restaurant. When you eat in a restaurant, you eat more, you eat less healthily. I don't leave myself enough time, and so I'm stuck with the thing I brought with me, that healthy lunch I packed in the morning when I was full of good intentions and not hungry at that moment. So it was easy to pack a healthy lunch. So those are just some ways to keep tempting food away. But another thing to do is to put up obstacles. And obstacles work great. Obstacles work great if you put them between you and tempting food, because people in general, myself included, no judgment here, but all of us human folks, we are lazy. So obstacles, they stop us or slow us. So let me give you an example. This comes from a study that my colleague Denise de Ritter did in the Netherlands. She showed that, you know, if you have a bowl of M&Ms right there next to your hand on the table, you'll eat a lot. If you put them 5 feet across the room, you'll eat much, much fewer. And that's a big obstacle, actually. You have to stop what you're doing. You have to get up. You have to walk across the room. But here's the crucial part. If you take that same bowl of M&Ms, keep it on the table, that's right where you're sitting, but instead put it so that to get an M&M from the bowl, you have to reach your arm. You have to extend it fully. You have to extend it 2 feet across the table. You'll eat as few as if you have that bowl across the room.
That seems unbelievable to me, because I'm one of these people who, when there's chocolate in the cupboard, I will get up and go across the room and open it up.
Yes, but you'll eat less than if it was right in front of you. I mean, I think people maybe are thinking about eating none. Maybe that's the goal. But I don't think that's the right goal. I don't think that's a goal that we can live with, to have none of the things we really like. So the goal here isn't to eat none. It's just to eat less. And if you eat less, you know, of everything all the time, you're fine. We need a middle ground between that heavy-duty restriction and eating everything in sight all the time. And so this is what I'm kind of recommending in the book, is this kind of middle ground, this leanest livable weight, have less.
Oh, let me ask you, too, because there are some diets that do seem to be more effective than others, and I'm wondering why. For example, look at Bill Clinton. He used to be, I'd say, on the upper end of his set range, and now he's way on the lower end. And the change that he made is that he became a vegan. And a lot of, it seems like a lot of public figures are going vegan, and they are losing a lot of weight, and he's been keeping it off for years now.
Yes, he's a very successful dieter, I would say. So when you say that some diets are better than others, there's lots of research that compares different kinds of diets. And what those studies show is that some diets might be better than others in leading to short-term weight loss. But there's no real evidence that anything is effective in leading to long-term weight loss. In every case, long-term weight loss, maintaining the weight loss, is only something you see among a small minority of people, which includes Bill Clinton.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with behavioral scientist Tracy Mann about her book, Secrets from the Eating Lab. It's about why diets don't work and how we can maintain a healthy weight. Now, talking about a healthy weight, you tackle this whole idea about obesity being so dangerous head on. And I think that was some of the most surprising part of the book for me. So give us the case for why obesity isn't as bad for you as we think.
Okay, I definitely think this obesity deadliness connection has been way exaggerated. So first of all, obesity is only truly dangerous at the really highest weight levels. Okay, and that's only about 5% of the population. So whenever people are saying 60-some percent of the population is overweight or obese and they're all in danger, no, the link really only seems to hold for the very heaviest. So that's the first thing. The second thing is research makes it quite clear that what matters more than weight is fitness. At any weight, you can become healthier by exercising, and you benefit from it whether or not you lose weight. Now, another thing, just to get into this whole death rate, I like to use death as my measure of health because it's easy to measure correctly, and health is actually very difficult to measure. So I, in the book, focused on death rates. Are there differences in death rates between obese versus non-obese people? And there's over 100 studies that look at this, and they've been summarized and analyzed very closely by a statistician named Catherine Flegel, who is in no way connected to any kind of diet companies or anything. So what I think of is about as unbiased as you can get. You know, her interest is statistics, not this topic. And what you see when you look at her summaries is that in most studies, if you compare the risk of death among overweight people to the risk of death among what they call normal weight people, and this, of course, is risk of death in a certain time interval. Everybody is going to die, of course, but in a certain time interval, they're not. Anyway, what she finds is that for over 90% of the studies, there's no difference in the risk of death between overweight people and normal weight people. Similarly, for I think 80-some percent of the studies, there's no difference in the risk of death between obese people and normal weight people. You only really see these differences when you start looking again at that highest end of the weight spectrum. And even then, the size of the relative risk is quite low. So I believe when you crunch it all together, the relative risk of death for the highest level of obesity compared to normal weight was about twice as high. But if you look at, just to put that number in context, if you look at the relative risk of death among from lung cancer of smokers versus non-smokers, it's about 30 times the size among smokers versus non-smokers. So, you know, these obesity death rates are quite small.
How does that account for, you know, all those studies that say there's a higher risk of breast cancer, of colon cancer among people who are overweight or obese, not to speak of things like diabetes?
Yeah, so diabetes is clear. Diabetes is obesity related. That one is clear. The other is much, much, much less clear and much smaller links, especially these cancer obesity links. But the main thing I think I need to point out is that all these studies have the same methodological flaw, which is that they're correlational studies. And the problem with this kind of study is that it can never say anything about what causes what. Okay, in this case, in the case of obesity and health outcomes, there's many alternative explanations, and the door is open for these explanations when you use these kinds of correlational studies. So there's several different alternative explanations that creep in here. And the first one I've already mentioned is exercise. If you're sedentary, you're going to have a higher risk of all these ailments. Obese people are more likely to be sedentary than non-obese people. So if you see a difference between obese and non-obese in some health outcome, it could just as easily be due to the sedentary aspect as to the weight itself. And the fact that when you exercise, you improve your health, whether or not you lose weight, suggests, at least to me, that it's the exercise issue that matters more than the number on the scale there. And that's just one of these factors that creeps in. Another one is poverty level, or what we call socioeconomic status. This has been highly linked to health. And what we also know is that obese people are more likely to have a low SES or more likely to be poor than non-obese people. So again, that could be accounting for health differences that you might come upon. Another difference is medical care, making use of medical care. Not just even access to medical care, although that is likely different too, given what I just said about poverty. But in addition to that, even when they have access, obese people are less likely to use medical care that is there for them because of weight stigma issues, because they feel uncomfortable with doctors. Doctors, as reported by obese people, doctors make them feel uncomfortable by constantly focusing on their weight and not talking about other things that they're there for, like a sore throat.
And you also talk about the stigma as a health risk in itself.
That's right. There is research showing that experiencing weight stigma causes a physiological stress response, which is, again, causes all kinds of health problems. Yeah, and these effects of weight stigma happen with even just small situations. Oh, gosh, one of the studies in there looked at people who were either videotaped or audiotaped in having a conversation. And just being videotaped instead of audiotaped led obese people to have a stress response. Just the thought that someone might in the future see this videotape was enough to set off this stress response.
Yeah, this was all very interesting. And you followed up also with a discussion of the researchers themselves, the conflicts of interest that those researchers who have come up with studies showing dire health impacts for people who are overweight or obese are often being funded by the diet industry.
Yes. No, it's kind of terrifying if you think about it. Studies of the effectiveness of diets and studies of the dangers of obesity, there's always authors on those studies who have not just one tie to some kind of diet study, but many, many ties. I think I gave the example from one of the papers of one of the authors having received money from 148 different companies, and that included every diet company you could think of, you know, Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, SlimFast, all those things, plus the makers of weight loss drugs, plus the companies that manufactured the deadly combination therapy Fen-Phen, which used to be used for weight loss until it was found to be very dangerous, and the lawyer who defended, the law firm, I should say, that defended those companies. So that's a lot of conflict of interest there. And, you know, we've only had to start in, I don't know, the last 10 years or so listing conflicts of interest in studies. And, you know, when I go back in time and review all these diet studies over the years, I don't know anything about the conflict of interest because they didn't have to report that then.
Talking about some of the other ways, some of the ways that we can maintain a healthy weight, and we talked about a couple of those strategies.
Yes.
But one of them that I'd never heard about before, and I was quite surprised that it works as well as the studies say that it does, and that's something you call eye intentions. Explain what they are.
Okay. Wow. No one ever asks me about this part of things. Okay. So that's a shorthand for a scientific term called implementation intentions. And this means that you think ahead of time about a situation you're going to be in, and you make a plan ahead of time, and you are very specifically supposed to make an if-then plan. If I'm at a cocktail party, and someone is passing around, you know, all these delicious and highly, highly caloric little appetizers, then I will take only one of each kind, or then I will have a drink in one hand and a napkin in the other. That will just make it a little harder to take some. The thing about these eye intentions is that there's a huge amount of research showing that they work really well. I was so dubious about these things when I first started hearing about them. But the evidence is really powerful. And I think the reason is this. They arm you ahead with a solution, with a way to handle something, so that when you're in the circumstance, not only do you have a solution, but you are already set recognizing that you're in a situation where you might need a solution. Otherwise, you'll start eating those things like crazy before you even think about it. So this way, it kind of gets you to think ahead of what the obstacles are that you have to deal with. So you're prepared to do it, and you're also primed to do it. It's almost as if you're turning something into a habit. And by habit, I mean something that works automatically without you having to think about it. If you can turn healthy eating into a habit, you're home free.
Tracy Mann. Find a link to her health and eating lab and its research at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.